Good morning. Two reports released by a national senior advocacy group show why everyone is affected by Social Security. Max Richmond, head of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, joins us with the reason why everyone is affected. And Neil Milner is back with the long view on the Electoral College. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Hawaii Symphony Orchestra cellist Joshua Nakazawa fell in love with his chosen instrument early. He'll tell us why and perform live in our studio. And playwright Annie Cusick-Wood takes on issues of tolerance and understanding in language a three-year-old can understand. Her play Blue opens this weekend at Honolulu Theater for Youth.
It's Wednesday, November 2nd. The conversation starts right after the news. Yeah, there are days I wish there were cameras in this studio. Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Chris Vandercook, yeah, you were bopping along there pretty well.
I was shuddering at the thought of cameras in here.
Oh, that was what it was. Okay, yeah. All right. Well, between you and Milner, you know, we had a party.
Exactly.
Welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Of course, you are Chris Vandercook.
All day. And morning, you're looking at the enduring mystery of the Electoral College.
Yeah, and why we keep trying to either, you know, replace it or modify it. We're going to talk about that this morning as Neil Milner is here with us. Every presidential election, you know, the odd and unique way America chooses its commander-in-chief always gets attention. Usually the criticism centers on the age of the method and how obsolete it seems to modern voters. But the Electoral College is part of the Constitution, and despite the fact that there have been so many attempts to either eliminate or modify it than perhaps any other part of the Constitution, the Electoral College is likely to remain. Contributing editor Neil Milner is here with all the reasons why. Good morning.
Good morning. At my age, if you're shaking in the studio, it's not necessarily because of the music. Anyway.
Okay, we're going to let just that
yeah,
one
let's move on.
But I want to talk to you about this because we've seen, you know, this populist view that, you know, the Electoral College is obsolete. It doesn't represent modern voters. We should do something about it. And there have been some attempts. Maybe the most robust attempt was the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. So let's talk about that one for a little bit. It's got, what, you know, 10 states, including Hawaii.
Yeah, I mean, this is an attempt really to do a kind of an end run around having a constitutional amendment, which is what you need to get rid of the Electoral College. The way this National Popular Vote Interstate Compact works is that states agree, a state legislature passes a law that says that we will, our electors, keeping the electors, will vote for whoever gets the most popular votes in the country. So in other words, you're going to vote for the most popular vote candidate, not necessarily who won your state. The theory goes like this. There are 10 states that have passed this now. Once it reaches the majority of electoral votes, about 270 votes, that is states that go to that, then it would go into effect. These interstate compacts is kind of a legal thing that's in the Constitution where Congress has to allow states to make these compacts with one another. That's not the big problem. The big problem is to get 270 to do it, and right now we only have 10. It doesn't 10 states with maybe, I don't know, 100 electoral votes, I'm not even sure. But it's not moving forward very much. But the main reason they've tried to do this is any other attempt to change the Constitution, and there's been hundreds, to get rid of the Electoral College, has just gone by the boards.
We've seen some books. We've seen some campaigns to do this. A book by political scientist George Edwards, Why the Electoral College is Bad for America, seems to also make a fairly cogent case. I mean, it may be one of many. Does it stand up?
Well, here's how it stands up. Pretty well. He's actually looked for evidence to support some of the arguments in favor of getting rid of it. And he's confronts some of the what he says is conventional wisdom about the people who want to keep the thing. For example, he says, if you believe in political equality, then everyone should have the same, every vote should have the same power, and the Electoral College doesn't do it. He says the founding fathers were not, in this situation, were not so all-seeing, anything like that. This was something that was done for expediency reasons, for good political expediency reasons. They didn't want to blow up everything else that was happening at the Constitution. They hadn't resolved this presidential thing at the end of it. And he said basically people were tired, wanted to go home, and wanted to get the Constitution started. So it's not like this is some kind of religious tract. And then there's all these other arguments about, he says it doesn't do what it's supposed to do. And I'm reasonably convinced by the way he went about this. He doesn't just lay it out in terms of patriotism. He doesn't sugarcoat the history. It's about as good an argument against the Electoral College as you can find. But the point is that it isn't going to have, it hasn't had much effect. And I would doubt if he thought it would.
Still, it seems to fuel a lot of conversation. And, you know, there are those who say, well, you know, given the argument that he's just made about how and what you reiterated about it being done for expediency's sake way back when the Constitution was formed, that there's going to come a time when this is no longer serving us.
Well, it depends what you mean by serving us, right? I mean, the majority of people, if you ask them in polls, they prefer that the candidate that got the most votes should get to be the president. Over time, it is, you know, we've elected minority vote people that did not have the majority of the presidency. Here's the situation that whether we can think about over time or not, it not being useful anymore. I can't imagine it being any more useful or any useful than it is right now. Think about it this way. Think about an annoying relative who comes to your house and is a guest there for much longer than you want.
We can relate to that.
We can all relate to that. And so what happens is that you and your partner or spouse have this discussion saying, we're going to keep this guy from ever showing up again. We're going to change the rules. We're going to move the house. The person leaves. Life goes on. You forget how bad this person was, how annoying this person was, because you have other things that are more important to consider. That's pretty much how the Electoral College changes tend to work. People get excited about it at a certain time, for example, after the 2000 election, the Bush-Gore thing. It stays around for a while, but let's face it, given that there still is some, you know, significant resistance to it, it loses its momentum because there are other things that are more important. If you've got a whole lot of other things on a political agenda that's more important, so it gets lost, and then it comes up again. And remember how hard it is to change the Constitution of the United States on the basis of amendments. So that's kind of – it's really not about the merits. It's about political life in general.
And just the difficulty of making change, period.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, but you can't underestimate the fact that the Constitution is so hard to change. That's why that interstate compact is a way of doing it. But as I say, it's important to some people at certain times, and then its importance disappears because there are too many other things on the political agenda. Think about it this way. When you think about what's going to happen, who's ever elected president in 2016, and you have your dreams and you have your anxieties and you have your fears, my guess is that the Electoral College doesn't appear on any of your lists anywhere. Even at the bottom, it just doesn't appear at all.
So, Neil, does all this conversation about the Electoral College really going to become a vehicle for venting a lot of anger at the presidential election? I mean, just being able to talk about something and point another reason why something happened the way it did?
Well, the way that Donald Trump has been handling this kind of thing, I don't think the Electoral College is the big issue. I mean, if you're talking about the whole election being rigged, there are broader things that are involved here. There is a good chance, but not a definite chance, that Hillary Clinton will win. And it'll be fairly narrow, but she'll have a large margin of victory in the Electoral College. I think that the election rigging that we're talking about now is taking on a whole different direction and a whole different life of its own. It's much more about beliefs and conspiracies and so on. So, again, I think the electoral – that's the – from my standpoint, that's the least of the worries of the 2016 election right now.
And what's the greatest one?
The greatest is that you have two candidates who are historically unpopular. You have a kind of coarseness in this campaign. You have – I mean, I'm tired of this junk. I think this has been the most depressing period of – the most depressing presidential election that I've ever had anything to do with as a voter. And I've been around – you know, I was in 1968, watched all of those kinds of things with Nixon and the convention in Chicago and so on. This has just been a god-awful election.
Well, on that happy note –
yes.
We will see what happens in now less than a week, and we'll talk to you tomorrow night. In fact,
yes.
On Town Square, you and Colin Moore, and I'll take a look at
Looking
the election.
Looking forward to it.
And glad you'll be here, and hope you'll plan to join us, too. Neil Milner is our contributing editor. He joins us every other week for a look at the long view.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's 8:15, and coming up, Hawaii Symphony cellist Joshua Nakazawa, live in our studio. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, you can get away with a lot if you're beautiful enough, and that has pretty much been the story with this invasive pest until recently. It's a colorful bird whose numbers have exploded in recent years. It's found in large numbers on Kauai's south side around Poipu, driving local residents crazy with their loud calls, leaving droppings all over the place. The birds eat mango, papaya, lychee, lettuce, long bean, tomato, other good things, causing more and more crop damage as their numbers increase. When they feed on invasive plant species like strawberry guava, they spread the seeds all around the island. Tourists who see them gather at sunset in the palm trees outside the Kukui Grove Mall aren't bothered by their loud calls. They're more likely to marvel at their bright green coats and long tails and their pinkish ring that the male birds have around their necks. But the local folks on Kauai, well, they'd be glad to see the last of Cetacula crameri, whose English name we're looking for today. Let us know if you know. Call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And the first one to get it right gets a prize.
Aloha, I'm Tulsi Gabbard, your Congresswoman representing the 2nd Congressional District. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
When you dedicate your life to a musical instrument, it becomes your voice, and over the course of a lifetime, you adapt to its strengths, its limitations, and its quirks. Joshua Nakazawa, cellist with the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra, committed to his chosen instrument early and is in our studio to demonstrate what it can do. Good morning, Joshua.
Good morning, Chris. Thanks for having me.
You knew pretty early on that this was going to be the instrument you were going to play, right?
Yeah, well, I made that decision that I was definitely going to be a career probably my last 2 years of high school, but I started playing when I was 3 and a half, so.
It must have been bigger than you were at the time.
Yeah, it was pretty big. They actually do have tiny eighth-size cellos.
Eighth-size, really?
Yeah, out there. They're almost just like violas, but they're cellos. I mean, a viola, I guess they are very
a vertical
similar anyway.
Viola, yeah.
But, yeah. But I started playing then. My mother played flute and took me to her rehearsals growing up. And I guess I sat by the cello section, and they were all very nice to me. I looked up to them. So I think that's probably what got me started.
I always wonder if people have frequency ranges that they're sort of tuned to the way an instrument is tuned to a frequency range, you know?
Well, in terms of the range of the cello, it's very a vocal instrument. Even just if you take a look at it, the size of the instrument is like the human body.
Yeah.
And so is the range. It goes very low, such that as a voice, and very high.
Yeah. Just hit me a low note and then maybe take me through.
Okay, so the lowest note is C. It goes, but then all the way up to maybe that high, which is, I guess, higher than the voice. But
it's higher than most voices, I tell you that for sure. And there's a richness to the sound that comes from a lot of different things. A wooden body, right?
Right.
And the fact that there are no frets, so you play your notes. You've got to find your notes sort of through muscle memory, don't you?
Yeah, through muscle memory, through kind of just building that map in your head. You learn where all those notes are. Yeah.
And then when you play a note, let's do a comparison of a note that you just finger and the note where you add some vibrato. Show what the vibrato does.
So vibrato is just like the voice when you're adding vibrato, but it adds a richness, adds more overtones to the note. So
that's straight up.
Straight up. And then with vibrato.
And what the vibrato is doing is giving you pitches just a fraction above and below, right?
Yeah, it gives you above and below, and by doing that it translates emotionally to having a variety of emotions, whether it's kind of like a very, very, well, not neurotic, but it could be very like a tense.
Yeah.
Or more of a relaxed, kind of, you know, overwhelmingly, joyful feeling or something.
There's a really wide variation, because that second time you started dry and then added more vibrato as the note went on.
Right, so you could start off with very little vibrato and have it get wider, or you start off with nothing and add it later. There are lots of options you can do in order to create your emotional
All of which are range. Things that the voice is great at.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of the times we try to, mimic voices, because that is the most natural form of creation.
It seems to have
the human body, so yeah.
And the voice seems to have the clearest connection to emotion. It's very hard to mistake the emotion in a human voice, right?
Right, absolutely, absolutely.
Well, let's leave time for you to play some Bach for us, Joshua.
Oh, okay, great. I'll play the Prelude of the Third Suite.
Uh-huh. Thank you. That was beautiful, Joshua. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bach has an amazing ability to take a theme and variations past where you ever imagined it could go, doesn't he?
Yeah, this is basically just a C major scale.
Yeah, I know.
You
could hear that it's a basic scale at the beginning, and then it goes all over the place. Just beautiful. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Real pleasure to have you in here. Joshua Nakazawa is a graduate of the Manhattan School of Music and Southern Methodist University, who is a member of the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra.
It almost seems a shame to have to get a reality check after all of that beautiful music, but we're going to move on and do just that. Now, the mayoral race may not seem as hotly contested as it once was. Still, that hasn't stopped the super PACs from raising a lot of money, over $1 million. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has today's reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, and yes, that Bach put me in a lovely mood, Beth.
It was wonderful. Well, you know, super PACs nationally raise an enormous amount of money, $1.5 billion. And looking at, you know, what we've seen happen here in Hawaii, remember, you know, 2012 and the PRP and that very contentious mayoral race. But this time around, it seems like almost a question, you know, why? Why all the money this time around?
Well, we'll see whether the super PACs are able to sway the election. Many argue that's exactly what happened 4 years ago with Pacific Resource Partnership. Certainly Ben Cayetano thinks so. He was the target of a lot of really, frankly, smear ads. He lost the mayor's race to Kirk Caldwell. Well, this time around, there are actually three super PACs that are involved, two in particular, one of them supporting Kirk Caldwell and one of them supporting Charles DeJoux. Now, when I say support, I mean they are working independently, right? Because super PACs cannot coordinate directly with a political party or with the candidates. But clearly, they are spending a lot of money. And I'll just name two of them. The first of them is Save Our City. You've probably seen the ads around town. Anybody but Caldwell.
Yeah, that giant truck that's sitting in my neighborhood. Yeah.
Well, exactly. And there's a big sign as you're coming in from Hawaii Kai as well. Well, this money, about $250,000, much of it coming from Dennis Mitsunaga. Of course, he's the well-known head of Mitsunaga & Associates, architectural engineering firm. And he, frankly, is just fed up with Kirk Caldwell. He said as much in a press release this week once the money was revealed. Now, the other PAC that's really critical is supporting Caldwell, and that's called Workers for Better Hawaii. They have much more money, nearly $750,000, and that's largely supported by unions, HDA, FL-CIO, and others, carpenters, and they are supporting the mayor, would like to see him reelected. So whether this money will make a difference, we don't know yet, but clearly they're spending a lot, and he can't miss the ads on TV and radio as well as those signs around town.
Yeah, so the big question is going back to that issue of why. What is it about this race that's causing both of these PACs to feel that they have to jump in when given the polls, including your most recent poll, showed right. Caldwell ahead by so many points?
7 points, and one wonders whether DeJoux can close that. There were actually quite a few undecided as well. I think rail is absolutely at the center of this. Remember, many of the unions are in support of the rail project. There's a concern with Charles DeJoux if she should come in, how that might change. Mitsunaga, he's not anti-rail. He's just anti-Caldwell. He thinks rail is going in the wrong direction. He even paid for a full-page ad in the Star Advertiser this week with his own money saying he's worried about whether the rail is going to be safe. So I think that's fundamentally at the core of this super PAC spending.
All right, we're going to leave it there for the moment. We'll talk to you in the morning.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Thanks, Chad. Chad Blair joins us every day from Civil Beat with a reality check. If there's someone in your family receiving Social Security, this next conversation is for you. The recent cost of living adjustment in the 2017 Social Security benefit may not be enough to offset Part B premium increases. That's according to one of two reports released by the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Their second report tracks the economic impact of Social Security across the nation and says everyone has a stake, an economic stake, in Social Security. Max Richman is the group's CEO and president. He joins us now from the Capitol with the reasons why and some of this impact on Hawaii. Good morning. Good to talk to you again.
Well, thank you for inviting me once again.
Let's talk about the cost of living, the COLA. For 2017, it's, what, a 0.3 increase?
Well, that's what the announcement was, a paltry 0.3%. I guess that's a little better than the current year, 2016, where it was zero, as was the case in 2010 and 2011. But that's not enough to keep up with the real cost of living increases for Social Security beneficiaries, the elderly and disabled.
So how much does that translate into in real dollars for someone?
It's about $4 a month increase on the average for an average beneficiary, you know, about the price of one Lipitor capsule. So, you know, it doesn't take into account the actual changes in cost of living for someone who's older and relying on Social Security. The measurement, the calculation for inflation for the purposes of COLA, we've been saying for years, is flawed because it looks at inflation as it impacts a wage earner. And one of the reasons we had a zero COLA for 2016 and a very low minimal COLA for the coming year, 2017, things like gasoline, which dropped dramatically last year in price, pushed down the calculation. But the, you know, the distinction is seniors are not using transportation, private transportation, using gasoline as much as a younger person, a wage earner, who's driving to and from work, dropping children off at school, picking them up. So that skews the calculation in a way that is harmful to a Social Security beneficiary.
For beneficiaries who are in places where there's a high cost of living, that's never taken into account, correct?
No, it's the same amount across the board. And that's a very good point because, as you know, being in Hawaii, and I've been there a few times, it's expensive. And there are other parts of the country where it might be less expensive. But the underlying problem is that the total market basket of goods and services and the weight put on those in calculating inflation should focus, if the purpose of a COLA is to make sure the Social Security check keeps up with inflation, then it should be based on the kinds of things that a Social Security beneficiary spends money on and needs to survive. And that is not the case with the current formula.
Especially when you start to look at how much they may be paying or seniors may be paying for Part B premiums, could they rise as much as 20%? Is that the prognosis
well,
for that?
Well, you know, that's quite a complicated discussion, but basically there's a hold harmless provision in the law where if the COLA is zero, as it was this year, this current 2016, or does not increase enough to cover what the increase is in the Part B premium, then about 70% of beneficiaries of Social Security and Medicare are held harmless. In other words, their cost would not increase beyond, for the premium, would not increase beyond the increase in the monthly Social Security check. So that will protect next year about 70% of beneficiaries. Those people that are not protected and will be vulnerable to double-digit increases in premiums are those who are new to the Medicare program, just signing up, are those who are not having Social Security or Medicare premiums deducted from their Social Security check, either because they haven't started collecting Social Security or they're in a category of employee, state, federal, local employees who are not part of Social Security. They're going to bear the brunt of this increase. So last year we were able to successfully lobby the Congress to make an accommodation and keep that increase down much lower than it would have been otherwise. But if that is not successful, those people that I just mentioned will see over a $20 a month increase, and in some cases quite a bit more.
Which certainly is not going to be offset by that $4 in the COLA that they'll get this next year.
Will not be protected by the hold harmless provision that's in current law.
Max, I want to move on with you and talk a little bit about the other report that you released that shows the economic impact of Social Security in states and counties, including in Hawaii. And the purpose of this clearly was to say that everyone has a stake in Social Security, even if they aren't retired or even if they're not even near retirement age. Why is that so?
Well, we thought it was important to have a broader picture developed about the impact of Social Security. We know how important it is to beneficiaries, especially those millions who rely on Social Security for all or almost all of their income. But what is often left out of the consideration, especially when there's a discussion of improving benefits or what has been more likely to take place in past years, cutting benefits, is the economic impact to communities. And so our Social Security Spotlight report broke down the amount of money that goes into communities across the country by county, by congressional district, and we were able to not only show how much money went into each state and each each county and congressional district, but also how that money filtered through the economy and helped the economies. Because keep in mind, most Social Security beneficiaries, when they get that check,
they
the average check
it.
Is about $1,300 a month, they spend it.
Right.
It goes right back into the economy. So in Hawaii, there are last year $3.7 billion flowed into the state through Social Security checks.
Are you talking about Hawaii specifically?
In Hawaii. And in the and the economic output, since that money went right into the economy and generated further development of and income, $6.4 billion was translated into $6.4 billion, and the amount varies by county. There's a county, I don't know where it is, I'm sure you do, Adams County. 30% of that county in Hawaii receives Social Security benefits, and that's a lot. In some counties, it's less. It can be 17%, but it's a substantial percentage of the population. And that money, as I mentioned, goes right into the economy and helps the economy, as you mentioned, for everybody, not just for beneficiaries. So that's why it's important that Hawaiians be observant of the discussions, pay attention to the discussions about Social Security in the next Congress, and be aware that any proposal or grand bargain that cuts benefits means everyone is going to be hurt, not just beneficiaries, but people who benefit from the program because of the money that goes into the community through the program.
Max, thanks very much. We got to go, and we'll talk to you sometime soon.
Terrific. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Max Richmond is president and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. He also chairs the group's PAC board, a nonpartisan committee that endorses candidates for federal office.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of.
It's just something that you want to do.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. One of Hawaii's most important archaeological sites is on Kauai. It's the Mokauwahi Cave Preserve. The remains of extinct birds and animals abound in this near-magical place. Some of these are thousands of years old. To get there, you crawl through a cave that enters into a huge sinkhole. It's the remains of a cavern whose roof has collapsed. Here you feel as though you're walking through time, for you're surrounded by incomprehensibly old rock walls and by the largest assortment of fossils in Hawaii and perhaps in the entire Pacific region. Support from a Hawaii Tourism Authority grant enabled paleobiologists David and Lyda Burney to study the area for 2 decades. In doing so, they've discovered what life was like here in the distant past. Because the fossils date back 10,000 years, long before the ancient Hawaiian culture began, the Burneys have documented what was here when they arrived. And I'll share that with you on another program. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
Aloha, I'm Jill Bolstridge from Ohana Arts. You're tuned in to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Twitter. Talk back to your radio at HI Conversation.
Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa. And Bert, I have to ask you, what's a hackathon?
What's a hackathon?
I know.
Well, I'm glad you asked, because basically, you know, there are a variety of different forms. It's where you bring together the community, and the hackathon sponsor will provide some resources in terms of some technology or some data or some kinds of maybe hardware that the community can develop and build something with. So the challenge usually at a hackathon is you know, here's a problem set. Here's something that we would like you to, you know, pour your creative energies in. And at the end of the hackathon, usually, you know, it typically lasts maybe 48 hours. You know, there'll be a set of projects that are like early prototypes. So that's kind of the outcome of a hackathon. And I guess in the case of what we're talking about tonight, we're going to be talking to the folks over at Purple Maya, and they came up with something called the Purple Prize. Now, their hackathon was more than just a 48-hour hackathon. They actually ran it for a couple of months, and but it wasn't a, you know, continuous involvement by all the parties, so they could work on it, you know, over that course of time. And they had a demo day a couple of weeks ago, mm-hmm. and we have invited some of the teams that were recognized. And the interesting thing about this hackathon was that they kind of brought together some Hawaiian cultural values and practices and try to see where that intersection existed with technology.
And there clearly is an area for that intersection.
Most definitely. And that area is called Aloha Aina. So we're going to kind of explore that concept as well.
Sounds like a plan, Bert. Thanks a lot.
Sure thing.
That's Bite Marks Cafe tonight at 5 p.m. Today's backyard quiz, a beautiful parakeet that has worn out its welcome on Kauai and has become one of the most destructive of invasive species there. It's an iridescent lime green in color, and males have a narrow pink ring around their necks. In areas where they're thriving, they're hard to miss around sunset with their loud calls, which can be deafening when they gather in large numbers. They eat a wide range of crops, but the damage doesn't end there. They spread invasive plant species along their flight path through seeds contained in their droppings. And even as they spread invasives, they pose a threat to native species feeding on koa wood seeds and other endemic plants. They're native to Africa and India and have been introduced to over 35 countries on 5 continents. Populations are found in Florida, Southern California, and all the Hawaiian Islands, and everywhere they've ended up, they've become a noisy, if colorful, pest. And by now, you've probably figured out we're talking about the rose-ringed parakeet.
And Daniel Vickers called us from Maui, from Makaua, and got the answer right, so we have a surprise winging its way to you. And now at 8:48, that's the end of today's Backyard Quiz. If you've got one for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Prejudice has to be learned. None of us are born judging others by their color. But something happens to people as they grow older, and that's why a play like Annie Cusick Wood's Blue, aimed at children as young as 3 years old, can play such an important part in their development. Through symbols that are easy to understand, it offers an object lesson in tolerance and dealing with the unfamiliar, and Annie is with us this morning. Good morning, Annie.
Good morning, Chris.
You've made a real specialty out of taking adult issues and making them comprehensible to very young children. I'm wondering how you do that.
I don't know. I just I really feel it's such a privilege to be creating theater for such a young age, and it's a privilege and a great responsibility. And I feel every show I do has to be something that I really care deeply about. So you know, if it has a great meaning like this, then it's wonderful. And I do take on big issues, you know, happy,
yeah.
blue, and the next one's home. And it's really rewarding to find the answer with the help of a great creative team as well. So it's always a challenge, but I feel it's really important, you know.
I'm sure it is. And you know, if you find the right way to reach the audience, it's mm-hmm. a very receptive one, right?
It totally is. And I find it through humor. That is the way. I mean, from the first second that something happens on stage, the children laugh, and immediately they go, oh, this is for us, this is funny. So it's always trying to find a humorous way through it. I mean, the story of Blue is two characters called Inky Blue and Sparkly Blue who live in a blue world. And their job in their blue world is to keep everything blue. And so I chose to set them in a laundry, kind of inspired by my own laundry room at home, which is always just crazy with odd socks and all that kind of stuff. You know, odd socks, if you've got any kids, you know that odd socks play a huge part in your life. You know,
they
just disappear.
Yeah.
So socks became really important in this laundry. So their job is to make everything blue all the time. True blue is what they aim for. And then one day, a red sock arrives. And one of the characters is like, you know, with the rules, it's not allowed, it's not blue, it's got to go out.
Yeah.
But the other one, Inky Blue, is more curious and asks, why? Why? Why does it have to go in the trash? And there begins the journey of, their discovery about, you know, just how wonderful that red sock is. And it's very fun. It's a very, very funny show. And I love watching the children watch it because they go through this empathetic journey with the characters and then also with the sock. So at one point when Inky Blue is banished from the blue world because he's like, I want to keep the socks.
Yeah.
And she's like, no, you can't. You got to go. He actually goes out. And the other day in a school, it was really funny. The van was parked outside the hall that we were playing in. And so the actor, Junior, walks out of the door, down the street, gets in the van and drives off. And the kids were just looking like, oh, he's really gone. And he really did go. Of course, he comes back in the end. Spoiler alert. But
yeah.
So they go through this empathetic journey with the characters and with the red sock. And it's really beautiful. At one point, there was a little girl who started to cry. Like, there was tears going down her face. And her teacher was like, oh, it's not real. It's not real. And she said, I'm crying. This is a story about washing machines and true love. It was so beautiful, you know. So I just love watching their faces because they are with it every moment. And, you know, it's such a joy to be able to share these stories with them. So they'll, you know, if a red sock arrives in their world, they hopefully won't banish it, you know.
Well, the fundamental thing that you're addressing here is our discomfort, our even fear of the unfamiliar.
The fear, absolutely fear, because Sparkly in the beginning doesn't even want to touch it. I mean, she has to put on a glove.
Yeah.
She's terrified.
Just because it's unfamiliar.
Because it's different, because she's never... Although she knows what it is, because she's one that says it's a red. Mm-hmm. So she's heard of it, or she's, you know, that's a background that, you know, that's her background, but she knows it's a red, but she knows it's got to go away, that it can't be allowed here. So it is about fear. And of course, there's a beautiful scene where the curious character, you know, wakes up in the night and sneaks out and takes it out of the bin and dances with it and falls in love with it, you know. So it kind of goes against the grain. So he's the minority, although there's only two of them, but if you think of the blue world, he's in the minority by standing up for what he believes is right and trying to, you know, understand it and sees the good in the red sock. And it's very brave to be in a minority to stand up like that, you know. And the consequence for him isn't great. But still, he goes off, and then, you know, it all works out beautifully in the end, and they have a colourful world in the end. But, you know, both of them go through a journey. It's great.
It's frequently more difficult to have an open mind than to stick with the mind that you woke up with that day, right?
Yeah, I think so. This definitely allows kids to think about, because in the beginning, they are actually with the strong character saying, they also agree, put it in the trash. The children say that, put it in the trash.
Really?
Yeah, they do. So in the 40 minutes of the show, they also come around to thinking, oh, okay, yeah.
No, so you actually sort of take them to the edge of agreeing with that idea.
They totally do. They totally do, because they go with the majority. You know,
then they
stand back and they question it and they go, oh, he's standing up for something that he believes in, you know. So it's really interesting. I read recently there was in 2015, there was a scientific research by the University of Arkansas who had like said nearly 700 students and took them to see a live play. And then some just read a book or watched a movie. And it proved that the children who saw the live theatre had more understanding, more tolerance and more empathy for the characters than those who just read a play, read a book or watched a movie. And I think that's something to do with the energy, the essence, the live interaction between, you know, the characters, you know, what we were talking about earlier about the space in between the words, the feelings that they're emoting, you know, there's a beautiful tension in the room. There's joy and there's tension. And gosh, I have the luckiest job in the world. I mean, really, I feel so privileged to do this kind of work and so thankful to HTY for allowing me to explore these ideas, these big ideas for the young audience.
When there are other people in the room, I think that the essence of the whole magic of theater is you almost have to empathize when there are other people right there in front of you.
Yeah.
Trying to reach out to you.
Yes, definitely. And there's a beautiful community shared empathy that goes along as well, you know, that what the children do often is they look at their peers, like, what are you thinking? How are you reacting? They're looking for signals all the time.
Uh-huh.
Is this okay? Is what he's doing okay? And that is a huge lesson to me about how we operate in society, you know. You know, it's beautiful. So, like, if they're laughing, I'm going to laugh. If they think it's okay, I'm going to think it's okay. But the more people start to stand up for Inky Blue and, you know, him wanting to take in the red sock and all the other colourful socks that arrive, you know, it's a gorgeous process to watch. And I would love to see, you know, I mean, I'm sure we will. We always get feedback from the schools. The teachers love it as well. You know, when I create theatre, of course, it's for the young kids, but it has to be for the adults as well. It has to be for the grandparents. I don't want them going, oh, when is this going to be over, you know? And it's, you know, I think with this one, it's been done a couple of times by other theatres as well. It's going to be performed in Dallas next March, and Washington, D.C. Imagination Stage did it last year. So it's kind of one of these shows that is going on and on. It's going to have a long life.
It's a lovely message, Annie. Thanks very much for coming in.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Annie Cusick-Wood is the author of Blue, which runs the next three Saturdays at 9:30 and 11:30 a.m. at Tenney Theater at the Cathedral of St. Andrew in downtown Honolulu. And you can find out more about it on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, announcing a fall open house where parents can learn more about the school's educational experience, Sunday, November 20th at 2:30, sacredhearts.org.
Annie is really not afraid to take big ideas and present them to three-year-olds, and she's found a language for that. It's
well,
wonderful.
Three-year-olds get a lot more information than sometimes we give them credit for. And understanding feelings and how someone could be made to feel as an outcast, and especially, as you say, you know, the journey the child goes on during that play is really quite something.
Yeah, no, it's a lovely, lovely concept. But just being able to understand that audience is a real gift, I think.
Yeah, especially for so much of what kids that age are presented, which usually have some sort of marketing tie-in or some sort
exactly.
of gizmo that goes with it. It's nice to just have something that purely reaches their hearts, minds, and spirit.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, that's going to do it for us for this Wednesday. And coming up tomorrow, we've got a lot more good stuff for you. And if I could find it, I would tell you.
Well, Yasu the Magician is going to be on our show tomorrow. He's on a tour of Hawaii libraries. And we'd like to hear from you. Call us at our talkback line, 808-792-8217. Email is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
And if you missed any of this show, you can find it on our archive with all the other ones. All you have to do is look at the conversation page under talk shows on hawaiipublicradio.org.
I'm Chris Vanderpool.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning with more of The Conversation.